Hi, I'm Marion Walling. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Lindsay for asking me to speak tonight. And because it's, I saw Molly a minute ago, and I remember what she said. And I feel the same way. It's such a great honor to be asked to speak in front of your home group. I didn't say I liked it. I just said it was a great honor. And I'm trying to remember that right now. Okay. I've stayed sober with your help and the books and God's help for 33 years. You would think I'd know a little something to talk about, but at the moment I want to tell you my story. That's the only way I know how to do it. And what I love is that the three speakers here tonight all ended up here and with the same feelings, and none of us started out the same. I was born to a family, and we lived they're just my sister and I. We lived most of our lives in Glendale. I went to local schools. I didn't drink. I didn't know anybody who did drink. But I'm 72, you know, and a lot of people didn't do that then. It wasn't like it is now. And so it wasn't available to me then and my group of friends. And then I went on into nurses training. That was during the Second World War, and it's a wonder I got through. Because what I remember my whole life until I got to you and sometime afterwards, and certainly on occasions like tonight, is that I have lived my whole life being afraid of everything, just everything. You and them and anything that came into my life, I was terrified of. And so I don't know how I got through nurses training, except it was during the Second World War and they desperately needed bodies. And because I used to hide in the bathroom. You know, they would say, this is what we're going to do today, and then they'd say, where is she? And I'd lock myself in the bathroom until I think the trouble is over. And I mean, I did that whether we were giving bed baths. It wasn't about anything really tremendous that I did. When I had to do my surgical training, I lost 30 pounds in like 6 weeks. And I know they would have let me go if they hadn't just desperately needed us. They really did. So somehow I got through. And I passed my state boards because I've always been good on paper. I'm very good on paper. You don't want to... I'm good at theory, I'm telling you. Performance leaves a lot to be desired, but theory is my middle name. And so I did great. And I passed now then. I'm 21. The war is over. I'm married the first guy who asked me that I had known all my life because... I knew nobody else would. I couldn't believe he did, you know. And in those days, everybody got married. I mean, that's what you did. Everybody came home from the war, and you got married. Or you were a nurse or a teacher. That was what was open to women then, at least the women that I knew. And so I married this guy, and he was still in school on the GI Bill. He was going to SC, getting his degree in biochemistry, which was wonderful for us because I'd started drinking about then, but we didn't have any money. I can't remember what we used to get, $65 a month or something. And so he would bring home 5-gallon bottles of ethyl alcohol. And then we made things out of it. We made gin, and we made cream de menthe, and we made... Oh, it all tasted the same, but we... Yeah. We colored it differently, and we just and everybody liked to come to our house, I'll tell you. And that was then, at least where I grew up, in my early married life, I lived at the beach, and everybody I knew lived in Hermosa and Manhattan Beach. Our whole life was spent on the sand, drunk on the sand. And we had the parties we would have with the ethyl alcohol. We used to have we'd get watermelons, scoop them out, mash up the pulp, pour ethyl alcohol in, put the pulp back in, drill holes in the side for straws, and then everybody would lie on the floor and you would drink, you know. And the reason you did that is because once you start drinking this stuff, you couldn't get up. Everybody. And they all stayed over. You know, nobody went home. They stayed over, and the next morning I would get out and there they would be. And well, I never thought anything about it. I thought, that's what you did when you drank. I thought that's what happened when you drank. I knew really very little about drinking. And all I know is that as opposed to the way Norma, and I can't remember the young man's name, I never did like it. I didn't. I just knew that I wasn't quite so afraid when I drank. And I thought, maybe I'll be able to somehow get through life, because I really didn't know what I was going to do. I was afraid to work. I went to work, but I was afraid every day that I was going to make a mistake. I was afraid that, always afraid that you weren't going to like me. I was always, and I didn't know how, I didn't have a clue as how to get life together. I laughingly say this, except that it's the God's truth. I didn't know how to cook and make a bed on the same day. Forget that. I just couldn't do it. Everything was monumental to me. I'd had no role models for that, and I'm, you know, my poor mother would feel terrible if she heard this, but I just wasn't ever home to observe how she did it. And I didn't, I'm not quick, and I didn't pick up on it. So I just had an awful time, and I ended up, and then my husband would bring people home from SC, from the graduate school, and I had, you know, I already feel inferior. Now I'd gone for a year at Glendale Junior College. There were two of us in our class of, I don't know how many, several hundred at Glendale High School who went to Glendale Junior College. Everybody else went to SC or UCLA. And that, I've always remembered things like that to cement the fact that I felt inferior because I am inferior. I mean, they went to the big schools, universities, I went, that's why I'm different, that's why they're not going to like me, that's why I can't carry on a conversation, that's why, so I don't want to risk being rejected by you, so what I do is act arrogant and reject you first. And with that kind of attitude, my group of friends dwindled down. But as this goes on, and as my husband, who is at school all the time and drinking a lot, and our crowd is, we just had booze delivered on the, delivered to the volleyball court, and in those days it wasn't quite the spectacle it is now. You know, women were not allowed to play volleyball. They were lucky they let you walk in the ocean that time. And so the women just sat around and drank. And I thought everybody drank like I did. And I never drank well. And it wasn't long before I would have to drink to get out of the house to go to your house, because I didn't know how I was going to talk to you even. And I would be terrified if you left me alone with somebody I'd never seen before. And so I would drink before I left the house. And then by the time I got to the house, my husband would open the car door and I would fall out. And that's what I did. I mean, that's how I went here. And then somebody would help me in, and I would sort of come to, and I'd remember eating or doing something, but I was drunk all the time. I never drank well. It didn't take a lot. I just escaped, and I liked it. I didn't care. I didn't care if I never did anything around the house. I didn't care if he left me, if I just had something to, money enough to get along on. All I wanted to do was try and just, I've never found a better way of describing it than this. This is the way it seemed to me. I just wanted to keep my skin from blowing apart. It was so scary. And I knew I couldn't keep it up forever. I knew that it was taking more and more. I knew that there would be days that I wouldn't remember. I did blackout drinking almost from the beginning. I sort of thought you did, but then when I began to lose days and things, I would end up at a friend's house. And finally, we were talking about this the other day. Oh, I met a new woman the other night, and we were talking, and I said something about her family. Do they mind if you drink? She said, well, no, I go to the neighbors and spend the night. And I said, well, you know, I used to do that too, until finally they said, you know, you can't come here anymore, because we don't care that you're drunk, but we sit up half the night because we're afraid you're dead. Because I would go in and pass out, and they sometimes were worried about whether I was actually breathing, and they'd stay awake and watch me. So they said, please don't come anymore, you know. And I thought we all drank the same way. I mean, I there was no other alternative for me, because this feeling of just blowing apart, and I just simply wanted to stave off the time when somebody was going to institutionalize me. I knew it was coming, and I just, you know, I'll think about it tomorrow, just have, and by this time now I am drinking, and I always like to mention this in case, just in case, they don't have it anymore, because they don't even have Safeway stores anymore, but I just want you to know what kind of a drinker I was. I drank festival wine, which was 39 cents a fifth, and you could buy it at Safeway. And I just loved it. It fit in my big wicker bag that I carried with me everywhere, and I could buy it when I bought the groceries. And so that wasn't too bad, but every once in a while. Now, my husband drank too, and I understand, after I was here 4 or 5 years, I understand that he is now sober in AA, and I surely hope so. But at the time, he was a heavy drinker too. And once in a while, I would wake up in the middle of the night because that's where I was in my drinking. I was like maybe in my 30s, 35, something like this, and I would wake up in the middle of the night and need a drink, never slept the night through, and wouldn't be able to find one. Well, now I got to get something to drink, and if it was before 2 o'clock, now I got to hustle myself. I can't get to the grocery store, so I got to get to the liquor store. And I don't want to forget this part because I really don't ever want to do this again. I really don't want to live like this again. I don't want to walk into a liquor store and have the guy just go and take the bottle down and set it in front of me, and then I take my purse and I empty it all out because I can't handle coins. I can't pick them up. Sometimes I can't separate dollar bills. And so I just empty all my money out, and he takes whatever he takes. I don't care. And then I would scoop it over the counter back into my purse and take that bottle and hope that someplace, and it was only maybe 3 blocks from our house, someplace between my house and that liquor store, I'd be able to stop and open it and have something that would get me home. And sometimes I could, and sometimes I couldn't. And there was sometimes I would hear people talking about me, and I would hear them say just a simple thing, there she goes again. You know, you could say that about anybody, but I'm guilty. I'm drunk, and I know it, and there she goes again means a whole different thing to me. And that was right. There I went again. And so it got so bad that the days were so running together that I no longer, I didn't bathe. I didn't dress. It was too complicated to change my clothes. I just, I would be in one thing, and then I'd come to, and then maybe I would be in a nightgown, and then the next, maybe I'd be in jeans. I didn't drink all the time, but I passed out most of the time. Byron and I were talking about, I don't think I wanted that. no, scratch that one. That's for another time. And somebody I knew said that there was a girl in our group who didn't drink anymore. And I called her. I think I was about 35. And I called her, and she came over, and she took me to my first AA meeting in Manhattan Beach at the clubhouse there. And here I walk in, and it's a lovely room, maybe 10 or 12 women sitting in there. And they're, there they are. They're women. And they're all dressed like I know I'm not. And now I know by looking at them, just like I've always known, they all went to SC and UCLA, and they spot me coming in. There's a girl from Glendale Junior College, I can tell, a mile away, And so I am really, now all I want to do is get out of there. But this is what I do when I feel like that. What I do is I do what you do. You raise your hand, I raise my hand. You say you're an alcoholic, me too. We don't drink. No, not me. Never will again. I know. So I said all those things, and I would go for 2 or 3 days, and then I'd drink again, and they wouldn't see me, and then they didn't seem to mind for a while. As the months went into years, it began to get kind of tiresome for them. And then they started bringing me into West LA to the Ohio Street meeting on Wednesday nights, which was a closed women's meeting, and that was dreadful experience because they went around the room like we do on Friday nights, and they said their names and their length of sobriety to the day, and my mind always changed. And so that got very uncomfortable, so I didn't go there anymore. And then finally my husband and I decided if we just moved to Palm Springs, we'll be fine. That's what we need to do. Bought a hotel, moved to Palm Springs, and then it really got bad. Then I just, I didn't go back to AA. Because now I'm drunk all the time, I can't even consider getting sober. And somehow or other, I'll tell you what I meant. 1963, this is what I remember. 1963, President Kennedy got shot in November. And then I remember sometime the end of May. And I woke up, and I couldn't find anything to drink in the house. And now I don't know what to do because now I can't drive anymore. I can barely walk, but I'm sure not driving. I never got in the car and drove. And so I don't know what to do. And then I remembered somebody, one of the patrons said they were leaving some liquor in their hotel room because they didn't want to drive with it open in the car. And I hustled my little self over there. And I always want to do it because I, you know, when I talk like this, I am, of course, hopefully, I'm talking to the newcomer, but I am talking to myself because, yeah, I've been sober 33 years. And I don't think about this every day, you know, but I just don't ever want to forget that this really is the way it was. And the way it is, when I need a drink, I need a drink. I don't care how I look. I don't care how you see me. I don't care if I've got clothes on or not. I don't care if I can barely walk. None of that has any bearing on it. I've got to have a drink. I have to. So don't get in my way. Don't anything get in my way. And I hopped right out of bed in whatever sort of little ensemble I had on and went over to that room outside our apartment, into their apartment, opened the door. There's the bottle of bourbon or whatever it was on the dresser. And then I drank some of it because that's what I came for. I didn't come for to find a glass or to close the door or anything. I came there to help myself endure the next few hours. So I poured a slug down without a glass, of course, and it ran all over my nightgown and my feet. And I looked up and there was another couple looking in the doorway that were in AA and they saw me do that. And that's all I remember for the next 10 or 11 days. It doesn't matter. I've never been able to pin it down. And then it was June 11th, 1964. And I called. I didn't know who to call down there. I'd gone to a few meetings, but I didn't know a name, you know. I didn't want to walk in without a name. And so I so admire people who come in here, you know, say, find out where the AA meeting has come. I couldn't have done that. And I didn't. I called a friend I had up here and said, I think I need to get into Friendly House. And she said, well, are you going to go back and live where you live? And I said, yes. And she said, well, then get sober where you are. And slammed the phone down. And, you know, I have no problem with God always working in my life. I really don't. I had known that woman for a long time. She'd always been kind to me. And she was sober at the time, like 10 or 12 years. Well, the fact of the matter is she wasn't sober. She'd been drinking for a couple of days. And she's back now and been sober a long time, 25 years or so. But that was obviously the message I needed to hear. I didn't need to go to Friendly House. I needed to stay there and do what I was supposed to do or the best I could. So I couldn't go to a meeting for a couple of days because I was too sick. I couldn't walk. My husband is humiliated. He functioned. I never did. And so I had to wait for a couple of days till I could get to a meeting. And I walked in on a Monday night, and it was a great big hall in a Methodist church. And the meeting had already started. And here's a whole circle of people sitting in the very center of this, what seemed, may not be that big. I'd have to go back and look at it. At the time, it seemed very big. Seemed like they turned around, and I made a lot of noise walking up to that little group and finding some place to sit. And then they were talking about what I don't have any idea. I just was there. And I had no hope for this working. I thought I'd tried it, but I just didn't know where else to go. I had no idea where else to go. And I just came in and sat down. I thought I did everything you ever asked me to do. I didn't know what I'd done why it hadn't worked. Well, I did know why it didn't work for me because I am different. I don't care what you say. I am different. I'm frightened all the time, and I'm nervous, and I have anxiety attacks and panic attacks, and I don't think you understand. I can't survive just walking from my house to the car without something to take care of that because I'm too scared. And now you're telling me that some silly stuff that you read is going to help me? Well, it's not, because I'm an alcoholic, but I'm crazy too. And I just don't want to be institutionalized. I just don't want to. And that's what my thoughts are going around. So obviously, I'm not listening to anything. But I remember that you talked about sponsors, and I had never done that. I don't know why I got up. I have no idea. I even went up and called her on the phone. I never even saw her. I just went home and somebody had given me her telephone number and I called her and asked her if she'd be my sponsor and she said yes and I hung up. I mean, and that's the way it started. You know, that's the way it started. I have no idea. And, you know, I really don't know how it all worked together. I know the book tells me what to do. I know the steps work. But somehow or other, there's something that goes on here between you and I that make it possible. I get, you know, I'm 33 years sober. I come to 3 meetings a week, and I have commitments. And I've heard this stuff a few years, you know. It isn't that I don't know what you tell me here. The trouble is I need to be reminded of how to do it or when to do it. I heard Georgia talk Monday night. She's 4.5 years sober. Let me tell you, I went home and did a few things I haven't done for a while because she reminded me that's why I was feeling bad. Left to my own self, I can't always figure it out. I give very bad advice to myself sometimes. You know, I need the contact with you. Because this is so important to me, I am responsible. They were here for me. I am responsible now to be here for the next guy. However pitifully or poorly I do that, it doesn't matter. I have that responsibility. And it doesn't matter how long I'm sober, as long as I can walk up those steps and get in here, I gotta be here. But it isn't just for that, it is also for me, as Georgia so clearly reminded me. Because I've turned around now and I've gotten, now I married a man in the program, I need to say this because it's important for me to remember why there are so many things in the book, the big book that apply to me, and one of them specifically is no human power. Because I really all my life have known that you could fix it for me. You just simply never loved me enough. You never gave me enough. You never said the right things. I didn't have the right parents, the right house, the right education, whatever that was. I didn't have it, and that's why I turned out the way I did. Yet nothing has ever been my fault. Believe me, nothing. It has all been you. And so now I'm still struggling with that because I was 3 years sober, I think, and I met Byron. And I just thought that was the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me. I'd never felt like that in my life. I just adored him. And so, now then. And he asked me to marry him, and there, you know, what could be, I'm home free. Here's this guy who is, and he's crazy about me too. And I mean, what a shock at my age with 7,000 wrinkles and all of this. I can't believe this guy really loves me, and I'm so thrilled, and I'm so happy, and I think that I'll just hop into these meetings, do the little things you do, and, you know, then there's a big thing that happens. The thing is, this gorgeous package of my husband, whom I adore, he has this big thing around his neck, and it's a tag, and it says responsibility, you know? See, he seems to want meals and things. He wants to... What can I tell you? He does. He wants clean clothes, all kinds of unreasonable demands he wants. It was the beginning of me finding out that I am responsible for my own well-being. There's nothing you can do. You can make me feel good, you know, but there's nothing you can do that gives me the feeling like I get when I answer the phone when I don't want to, when I put myself out for somebody that isn't my favorite, when I try to do things that. You know, it's such a two-way street, and I can't believe it's true, and that's what Georgia reminded me of Monday night. Byron, I married him. We are happy. We've been married 30 years or whatever, and 29 years. But in the middle of the night, when I have a problem, when I'm frightened, or when I don't know what's the matter and what's making me act so angry, or I don't know how to solve a problem that's going on in my life, and Byron is there, he is right next to me, and he can say, it's all right, you'll be all right, I'll take care of it, I love you. None of that means diddly. It doesn't help at all. No, and if Byron can't help, then no human power can. And so that means it's me and God. It's got to be me and God, because there's no place else to turn. When it's dark at night and there's, you know, nobody to call, there's no place else to turn. And so that's when I have to work on my conscious contact with God, because I don't know how I'd survive without that. But my life has expanded. I would like to have lived in a room by myself, and you could drop by on occasion and tell me what's going on at the meetings and maybe slip a little money under the door, and I wouldn't be able to, you know, I could have survived probably. But now I don't. Now we adopted a boy, we adopted a baby. I will be 42. He's 28. He and Marianne are the same age. And he's had a lot of problems. And we've been heartsick over some of them and not know how to handle them. And we had to pray about it and turn it over and make all kinds of mistakes. It doesn't seem to matter. And I thought it was of primary importance that I not make any mistakes. And I found out from you, through the book, through the steps, making mistakes doesn't have anything to do with it. Trying has something to do with it. Succeeding doesn't matter. Trying is everything. And making mistakes, as long as I don't, like Clancy says, try and defend them, I'm all right. Pick myself up and go at it again. I couldn't do that alone. I could not do it alone. I might sustain it alone a few days at home, but why would I want to? Well, I live so differently today. My life is so full today. No matter how serious it gets, no matter if I'm worried about Byron and his eye surgery, or if we have a hard, it's such a struggle for him to let me drive that car in here 3 times a week and drive home. I know how bad it is. He never says a word. You know, and I pray about it. I know we both work hard at that. Because it's important for me. What makes me feel good is being good. I don't know where I read it a long time ago. I don't even know who said it. But there's a line about, you better be good. It's better to be good. Let the rest of them be clever. And that's the truth. I wanted to be clever all my life. I thought I wanted to be witty. I thought that's what you'd like about me. And it doesn't matter what you like about me. If I'm good, I like myself. And when I like myself, I can just do about anything. I can survive anything because I understand about God and my contact with Him, and I understand the important part you play in my life. I cannot imagine. I just can't imagine what I would do without you, really. You do everything for me. You have all my questions. You have all my answers about raising kids or being married or being a good friend. I didn't have a clue as to how to be a good friend. I've never been responsible. Never. I can tell you I'll be there, but, you know, don't hold your breath, because that's not my style. I will if I can. I will if it doesn't inconvenience me. And I brought a lot of that into AA, you know. I'll pick up the phone when I don't do it anymore because I don't feel good. I'd like to say I don't do it anymore because I want to be a wonderful person. And, well, I'd sort of like to, but I don't do it because it makes me feel guilty. Georgia reminded me of the important part she's played in her mother and grandmother's life and how difficult that's been for her. And Byron and I have 2 other children. We have a son and an older son and daughter, much older than Andy. And our daughter has been a problem for us, not for herself, just we're sorry about the way our relationship is going, and it's given us a lot of heartache. And what I want to do, I see her as being very wrong, very wrong. And I want to pick up the phone and say, listen to me, you know, but that's not my place. You have taught me that's not my business. She's free to act any way she wants to act, even when she hurts our other son. But what I have to do is all I have to do is what makes me comfortable. What makes me comfortable is picking up that phone every Tuesday at 9:30, calling her, telling her I love her, listening to what the kids are doing, being as kind and loving as I can, and hanging that phone up. That's the only thing that makes me feel better. There are still times when things go on that are hurtful to our youngest boy where I really want to call up and let her have it. But that's not my place. That's not my place. You have taught me that. You have made it possible for me to live so comfortably in my own skin. I don't worry about it blowing apart anymore. I don't worry about any of those things. I care very, very much for you. I wish I could tell you. There aren't words to tell you how dear you are to me. Thank you.